Mr.
Hello, WGN listening audience.
Live from the biggest small town in America, it's the Saturday Night Special with Amy Goode.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And like anything, classical music has the surface stories that say Beethoven was a prodigy, that Mozart composed symphonies despite being deaf. But also, like anything else, taking the time to dig into the stories below the surface is never a waste of time. Take, for example, 17th century composer Carlo Gesualdo, known for his expressive madrigals, but also for murdering his second wife and her lover. Or Franz Liszt, who inspired such intense fan frenzy that thought leaders of the day named a condition, Listomania, to describe the intense adoration directed towards the Hungarian composer. See there? Always worth digging below the surface. And as ever, that is what we are here tonight to do on the Saturday Night Special. So classical music, it's a genre that refers to a period of time, but also can be updated and refreshed for a modern audience. But as with any art form, context can open up our appreciation of its purpose, if not outright, have our minds positively changed by it. When we think of classical music, we think of years and years ago in Europe, mostly white guys long dead. But in fact, classical music is alive and well. It's everywhere. And Chicago, being a global city filled with cultures from around the world, holds that in ways that we may not see on the surface every day. From fresh contemporary and yes, even feminist takes on the classic concertos to the role music composers play right here in the Chicago film community, we are here tonight to take a look at a genre that is alive and well right in our fair city. I'm Amy Guth, and that is all coming up on the Saturday Night Special. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is a Saturday Night Special. Tonight we're talking about classical music, particularly in Chicago. We're listening to Vitamin String Quartet. That's a beautiful cover of Please Let Me Get What I Want by the Smiths. So, of course, I love it. For those of you who've been longtime listeners know I'm a big ol' Smiths fan, so I was delighted to find two things coming together. So usually here, after the opening monologue, we do kind of a little scene setter and talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing on the show tonight. Often we have a journalist come in who's done something of why we're doing this topic right now. But you know what? We don't have a news peg for tonight, Tom. We're just doing this because it's something we've been thinking about. Right. And it seems like, hey, music's a great thing. And also, we don't want to talk about politics. So let's do classical music tonight. That'll be great and soothing and chill. And let us forget about it being freezing outside. So my question for you, esteemed producer Tom Hush, is this. And that is, how do you feel about classical music? And well, let's start there. And then I have a follow-up question, potentially.
Classical music, I mean, it's just one of those things that has always, it seems like it's always been part of my life, yet I can still pinpoint exactly where I got very interested in it. I don't necessarily spend a lot of time listening to classical music, but when I do listen to it, it moves me in ways that many other styles of music don't. It really opens up my imagination a lot. It's a great thing to just sit and listen to. And I never do it when I'm like, you know, jogging or, you know, just sitting on the bus. Usually it's something I do at home and something that I can really relax and sink into.
Yeah. Yeah. I sometimes will use like classical music in yoga classes and things like that. And
oh, yeah.
Things like that. But yeah, it's not like, it's not necessarily, even like the big like percussion heavy songs are not necessarily going to give you the same effect as like a bass thumping hip hop song when you're working out, right? Well, okay. So then my follow question was kind of like how you got there. Like, did you have a specific inroad into appreciating classical music?
Yeah. I mean, I would consider myself always a musically minded kid. Both my parents are big music people, but specifically for classical music, I trace it back to, when I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, Disney did a sequel to their film Fantasia, titled Fantasia 2000. And the whole conceit is that it's a bunch of different pieces that are set to Disney animations, original Disney animations. And I remember watching that, and it absolutely blew my mind, and it really ingrained into my very young, impressionable brain that classical music is so much storytelling, and like it really kickstarted a lot of imagination. And now anytime I hear classical music, I feel like I go into quote unquote fantasia mode, and my brain is just drawing up images, as I'm sure it does for a lot of other people. And it just, I never got past it. Specifically, they did one for Rhapsody in Blue that really, really impressed on me, and it still makes me feel similar emotions.
Well, Gershwin there. Now. So that that was my grandparents' special song.
Yeah.
That was, so I of course love that song. Well, tonight we are going to be talking with the ladies of Bow and Hammer. They're a classical music duo, and that's very exciting. I'm very excited to talk about all their work. And then we're also going to be talking with our very own Dave Schwann, who is also a personality on the classical music station here in Chicago. So we will hear from him about what it means to be broadcasting classical music in this moment that we're in, because it's not like you're kind of competing in a different space at that point.
Totally.
And we're going to be speaking with composer Tony Scott Green tonight. So we're kind of like running through a lot of different people who have different perspectives on music. So that's very cool. So you want to stick around for all that for sure. But I would say, Tom Hush, I think for me, classical music has had different spots in my life. Like, my parents met in a jazz band, and for longtime listeners, I think you've probably heard me say that too many times. So music's always been a big part of my life, but I didn't discover until my 20s, maybe late teens, early 20s, that I really loved opera. I just really wasn't around it. And then I went, my mom and I went to La Traviata, and I was like, holy smokes, this is phenomenal. It's not what I thought it was.
What was it about the opera specifically?
You know, it was, I mean, I'm such a sensory person, and it took a lot of, it just took care of a lot of senses all at once. Like, you're sitting there, you're looking at subtitles to translate, to translate the words. You're listening to this very beautiful music. It's very theatrical and beautiful, and all this stuff is happening, and it was just lovely. And so I thought that was a really cool experience. So in a little bit later in my 20s, when I was in New York, I used to, 1 or 2 days a week, I would answer the phones at the New York City Opera just so that I could get free tickets, everything. Totally worth doing.
Boom.
Totally worth doing. And I got exposed to a lot. I mean, I was, whatever. It's very hard to live in New York City. It's hard to live anywhere. But I was young and very broke in New York City. And there's no way, I couldn't even afford to go out to eat. Like, I was so very, very broke. But that was such a special thing. Like, I would walk through Central Park over Lincoln Center and have like this beautiful afternoon at the opera, and if they had seats for me. I mean, it was always like a really crappy seat in the nosebleed section, but that's fine. It doesn't matter. You can just kind of take it all in and see all of the beautiful things. And so, like, Mozart's Don Giovanni. I love Don Giovanni. That's such a beautiful opera. And Tosca, the Puccini opera. Actually, I like a lot of the Puccini operas. Then it's like some cool modern stuff, right? Like the Totstadt, that Korngold. Like, there's lots of cool things. And then there's, I feel like we're starting to see more opera companies take chances and do kind of weird stuff and modern stuff that doesn't sound like the Lady in the Viking Helmet.
Exactly.
You know, it's not that. I mean, as with many things, right? It's not always what you think it is. I think on the outside, it's easy to dismiss something as saying like, oh, classical music is boring and stuffy, and it's for a certain kind of person.
Right.
And opera is this, and this is this. And so I think that, like, that's what I'm excited to look into tonight, is kind of challenge who's like, quote unquote, allowed to like classical music and listen to it and access it, and why.
And it's funny you mentioned the Lady in the Viking Helmet, because I really didn't like opera. I thought it was meant like something to be mocked, because my introduction to it was literally Looney Tunes, was Bugs Bunny like singing in the big Viking helmet, doing the whole thing, doing Wagner or whatever. And I was just like, oh, so this is like silly, right? This is like old, as you said, stuffy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much cool stuff happening, and I've by virtue of getting older, I've started to learn to appreciate and be like, oh, wow, this is actually really beautiful, sometimes radical, like La Boheme, which would go on to be the inspiration for Rent.
That's right.
Which I was like, oh, I get Rent. I understand Rent. Yeah. Maybe now I can understand La Boheme.
I think also another interesting part of classical music right now is that the marketing end of it, like there's songs that are used in marketing campaigns.
Oh, gosh.
That then you get it, or in cartoons. I think, actually, I think cartoons are like an early exposure that a lot of kids have to classical music. I mean, like thinking of like Peter and the Wolf, that whole suite. That's a beautiful composition, right?
Yeah.
And even just like the pretty lullabies that are in, you know, in a lot of cartoons, in a lot of Bugs Bunny, there's a lot of stuff like that. But in particular, like there are pieces of music that have become so ingrained in our head, not just classical. I would say like there's some kind of good, pretty hipster songs that are like, there's a Cymbalta ad with like a pretty Novo song in it. And I was like, oh, that's a beautiful song. Oh, it's for Cymbalta. Okay, great.
Great.
Right. Like there's a, Bach's cello solo, it's suite number one in G major, is in a commercial for like Northwestern Medicine's Cancer Center. And it's a very beautiful, kind of a sad cello solo. But now I hear that, and I've always liked it, but now I hear it and I'm like thinking of these like people in white coats going, we're a team of people here to save your life.
Yeah.
And I can't think, like I'm always thinking of that. So I think that's kind of interesting, like what we associate with different songs.
Yeah, you just can't get it out of your head sometimes. And it becomes so personal, even something as simple as a commercial, because then someone tries to tell you, oh, actually, it's about this. And you're like, I don't know. This still kind of reminds me of that one, Beef, It's What's for Dinner.
That was that Copeland.
Yeah.
There was a, like this very like lively Copeland composition that was in, I guess it was like the late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah, it was like a Beef, What's for Dinner commercial. It ran forever. And now every time I hear that, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's
well, it's so sophisticated.
The family chopping up steak or whatever.
It's hats off to the marketing team, by the way.
I guess.
We got to give it to them. They know what the people want. They know what's going to get stuck in their heads.
Okay, but I you know my war against buzzwords.
I feel
and
that.
Marketing speak, so mm-hmm. I'm not here for that. Okay, so I think we have our work cut out for us tonight. There's a lot of things mm-hmm. to talk about. I think too, you know, not only the association that we have with music, what it can do, like how it can stir different feelings. I'm very interested in kind of the access piece that I mentioned. I think we have narratives, and that is if you're playing Amy Guth radio bingo at home, you can just cross off the word narrative because that is, that there is a card. I have seen it. It exists.
I feel like it's the free space. Everybody gets it.
Everybody. I'm going to say narrative every show for sure. But I think that part is really interesting. I mean, that's the whole game of the show, right? Is like what is the main narrative and what is the real story and how do we challenge that main narrative and what pieces are we missing from it? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think even just by virtue of saying classical music, that is shorthand for white European composers.
Absolutely.
You know,
you're thinking Bach, you're thinking Mozart, yeah. all these guys, but it's got such a longer tradition. Not just outside of Europe, there's so many great American modern composers that really pushed the ideas of the classical period and of music in general. I mean, we saw Philip Glass recently was nominated at the Kennedy Center, and he is truly one of the great, you know, composers, one of the great classic, I guess you could call it classical in a sense.
Sure.
Or even people like John Cage with his very famous composition. I don't remember exactly what the number is, but what he does is he walks up to a piano. He lifts up the guard for the keyboard and he sits there and he doesn't play anything. And the audience just sits in complete silence. And then I believe it's like after 3 minutes and about 20 seconds, he gets up, puts the key card back down and bows and walks off stage.
See, okay, but fair enough. But you know that my threshold for tolerating pretentiousness is very low. I cannot. And that seems like horribly pretentious to me. And that's
it thrilled me.
Come on. Like, I think experimental versions of things, I'm all for breaking the rules.
Sure.
Once you learn them well enough, if you're just doing it because I can't be bothered, that's different. Yeah. Like, I mean, that was my like Project Runway gripe, right?
Yeah.
Like no one knows how to sew. So they're just like, I'm just going to pin things and make it avant-garde. Like, no, learn how to sew and then decide
if you're going to do,
if you're going to break the rules. But,
yeah.
And I think the same applies to music. There's some things that are experimental just kind of for the sake of being weird. And I think like gratuitous weirdness kind of lacks context sometimes, and it lacks the ability to stir emotions and move people. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, if you're really making a point about something, I think it comes through in an earnest way. But if you're just like, I'm doing this to, you know,
it's like overly intellectual.
Yeah. Then it's not accessible. And it's not. And that, to me, music is completely accessible. And I think it's an interesting moment in classical, right? When we think of what classical music was in its day, that was so about the elite in private settings. And now it's so open. So, well, we're going to talk about that tonight. We have lots of things to talk about.
Lots of work to do.
Lots of work to do. Yeah, so there's lots of organizations in Chicago that are doing very cool work. We have we've reached out to many. Lots of people busy this time of year, but that's okay. We've got an awesome, awesome lineup for you tonight. And we are going to take a little break, get you news, all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are talking with the folks from Bow and Hammer. We're going to talk with them about their very, very cool duo that really plays upon and highlights the relationship between violin and piano and really tries to focus on the communicative power of performance and social issues. So I'm very excited to talk to them. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for joining us. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with us. That very, very beautiful music that you're listening to is the work of Bow and Hammer, which is my guest right here, right now in the studio. How exciting is that? Bow and Hammer is here. Bow and Hammer, of course, is Catherine Sato on the violin and Elizabeth Newkirk on the piano. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. I'm going to turn all of your microphones on, so we're all good.
Great.
Great. Done. Welcome. So glad you could be with us. And so tell us about Bow and Hammer. I mean, I'm really interested in, from your website, you talk a lot about works from musical eras that highlight the relationship between violin and piano, which that part seems very straightforward. But then in the very next beat, you're saying things like that you build new perspective of chamber music through community by stripping away preconceptions in classical music and focusing on the communicative power of performance and social support. Whoa, I'm here for that. Tell me all about that.
Well, just a little backstory. We met in 2010 at a chamber music festival and really kept in touch and started playing together in 2012. So we've been continually building our concept of what we want to do and how actually we want our duo to play well with others.
I mean, I think that any chamber group has to kind of create their concept after they start playing together. So that has been kind of a continual journey and process for us. And what we've been able to do, which has been really nice, is find these different access points that are really directly affecting us and the people around us. And that's how we've come up with these different relationships, these different kinds of performances that we curate, different events. And so it's really beginning to bloom into some really nice things that we're pretty proud of, really happy to keep doing. So I would say that's a really small snippet of what we do.
Cool. And you have an event coming up tomorrow.
Yeah, we play on the second Sundays of every month at the Promontory in Hyde Park. And this show starts at 1:30 p.m., but usually from then on it'll start at 2. So it's sort of a great place to go have brunch and come upstairs, get a complimentary mimosa.
Nice.
And enjoy a nice concert.
It's kind of also a way for bringing the classical scene to a place that's more blues, or I guess they're not blues, they're more jazz, DJ oriented.
Yeah. Well, and that's a topic I want to touch on as we're talking here. And that's about, we have this idea of what classical music is, right? It's old, white, dead guys from Europe, and it's inaccessible, and the people that listen to it and like it are of a certain social class and just, you know, doing their thing, and that, sure. Right. And so I think it's really interesting when we start looking at other places where classical music can show up, should show up, is showing up. I think that's really, really fascinating. I know I've talked on the program before about Chicago Sinfonietta, who's done such interesting counter-programming to the symphony of like, hey, you got a bunch of white people, nothing wrong with that, but there's a lot of people playing, right? There's like a lot of people playing music and classical music, so let's do something meaningful there and look at composers from different backgrounds, which I think is really fascinating. And so to me, that speaks to, by no means is it like this old genre. It seems very fresh and alive in that way.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I mean, Kit and I personally really value this sort of loyal, regular culture. We're regulars at so many places in Chicago, and that's kind of easy to live in Chicago and have your favorite places to go. But connecting the dots is sort of, I think, an underlying way that we think. And so to have classical music, well, it just happens to be our language. So, of course, we see it speaking with chefs. We see it speaking with comic artists. We see it speaking with just small businesses. We see it speaking with community and finding access points just so that we sort of strip away this prerequisite of you need to have experience, you need to have all this knowledge, you need to have grown up with it. It's like that's totally, you can totally get around that. And a lot of our audience are new to classical music. A lot of our audience, it's their first time, but they don't have a problem relating with it because you can, of course, relate to someone jamming out on their instrument.
That's
so
right.
We really just encourage everyone having a good time and really trying to set up the experience in a way that I think is relatable.
I mean, I think also the thing about classical music is that ultimately, it's a product that's been tried and true for centuries. So in that way, it's just like the most verified product that you want to buy. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's something that's been around forever. So even if that has to change the way it's presented, it doesn't mean that the actual repertoire, the actual stuff needs to be quote unquote outdated or dead or, you know, any of those things. So I think that's one thing that we really like to approach from a different way, valuing the where we've all come from, all of our histories, and seeing what we can do with that going forward, because we are in this fast moving world, so we may as well keep moving forward all together using the tools that we have. And that's what we like to use classical music as a tool to move forward together.
I like that so much. What about your individual journey? So you met at a chamber music festival, but what brought you to music individually initially?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll go first. The story is that I saw some kid bring a violin to kindergarten show and tell.
Okay.
And I guess I asked every day since then to play that, to play the violin. I don't remember that story, but that's apparently what happened. But otherwise, there's always been music of all different kinds. My dad was like, listen to the jazz station and any other kind of easy music kind of listening, and my mom really liked the classical music station, or musical theater was really fun for us. So, I mean, we weren't like, I wouldn't say that we were avid symphony attenders or anything like that, but it just seemed like something that was fun to listen to. And then, of course, since I started really young, it was just something that continued to be something that we would always listen to or hang out with. And as I got older, I actually sang for a little while in college, sang a little bit here in Chicago when I moved here. I think that's kind of where I've gotten, and then meeting Elizabeth really worked out for us. Our playing really worked together, jives together, and it's really hard to find a chamber group where you play well together and your personalities mesh really well.
Sure.
So when you find that, you're kind of like, okay, great. How do we make everything else work?
I think that's with any band, right? That's what always implodes it.
Exactly.
About all the legendary bands, it's the personalities.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have a very typical story. I started piano at age 7, which is the sort of standard of when I was growing up. And I had really supportive teachers, and my parents were really supportive. And I sort of was just kind of your average piano student. And I was fortunate to get a trip to New York when I was 12. And I saw Phantom of the Opera and was like, oh, my God. So honestly, musical theater also was just like, even though that's not what we do. But yeah, chamber music is really a way to utilize sort of all of the skills that I value and like to work on. It's extremely challenging. It's very expressive, but it's also, you know, you constantly have to be accountable to somebody else. And sort of the team player aspect is, you know, I'm from Indiana, so I grew up playing basketball, you know.
That's right. We're talking with Catherine Sato and Elizabeth Newkirk. They make up the band Bow and Hammer, a classical music duo. They're live in studio with us tonight on the Saturday Night Special as we are talking all about classical music right here in Chicago. We'll be right back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. That very beautiful music that you were listening to is by Bow and Hammer, Catherine Sato and Elizabeth Newkirk, and they are right here in the studio, which is very, very exciting. And we have been talking about their work as Bow and Hammer and what all of that means when we think of a classical music duo. When we think of a any kind of musical group, I think sometimes just think about it as just the music, just show up and play and you're done. But in fact, you two are doing a lot more and really trying, it seems anyway, trying to build a lot of bridges and grant a lot of access to music that I think is really beautiful. Let's talk more about that.
Sure. I think that one thing that's difficult about classical music is it can become very isolated, very separated, and people see it that way. They see it as elitist. They see it as unattainable, kind of unachievable. And it's a tricky thing to balance because I think to have a professional career in classical music, you do have to have a lot of hours and hours and years of work and practice. So you can't invalidate that. You can't say that's not true. But I think that especially with the way that the workforce is going and whatnot, our careers are looking actually less different in some ways. You still have to figure out how to be a business. You still have to figure out how to promote yourself. You still have to make all the ends meet. And that is not as unique of a struggle anymore. So I think that the form itself might be very unique, but we've tried to make ourselves a little bit more identifiable as a small business more than, say, a classical music group. And I think it's made it easier for us to make connections with people that have skills that we don't or things to offer that we don't. So some of our things that we have different merchandise things from different, we have some coffee, we have some, you know, just other things that we don't do, but it enhances an experience, which is what any product does, right? Is it enhances your life, your lifestyle. And so that's what we want to keep in mind, is that we're trying to contribute to your lifestyle in this way of live performance, of connecting with people, because that's what classical music can do.
Yeah, and we sort of focus in on a lot of other industries and what they've done. And a particular industry that has really captivated our attention in a lot of ways is sort of the local slow food movement. Mm. And the way in which they've engaged with dialogue, acknowledged different levels of process that needed our attention, have revived this sort of keeping, you know, time, dinner time, valuing where sourced food comes from, valuing the job of a farmer, just all these aspects of dialogue, I think, have been very inspiring. Because when people, like, kind of to set just compare, like, well, we can't farm like we did in the 1800s, but yet we need to be more, you know, it's sort of that twofold argument. Mm-hmm. When you apply that to classical music, it becomes really stifling and like, oh, well, you're going to be playing white guys or not. And so we try to really keep the conversation fresh by, one, valuing the profession as a profession and being open to listening to how can we engage. How can we answer, like, what do you need to sit down for an hour concert? You know, like having prep, that there's social time, that there are drinks, that there are multiple media outlets. All of that does is just sort of allow people more success to be engaged. So that's always on our radar and always on our sort of prerequisite of like, well, what do I need to go to a concert? I'm not special just because I play the piano. Sometimes I'm not in the mood for a concert. So
sure.
We just really try to set up the experience so that it's engaging, memorable, and, you know, special.
Mm-hmm.
Also, to zoom out a little bit from the music, we're just acknowledging that we're human. We're all human. So mm-hmm. we all have different skills. We all have different professions. And classical music isn't different from that either. So when we make our events, what do humans need?
Yeah.
Time with each other, time to unwind, time to decompress. And thankfully, our performance art form does that on its own with the right kind of space.
Mm-hmm. And, so, and I mean, it seems almost like there's a little bit of an activist thread going through a lot of what you're doing in terms of like who you're partnering with and things like that.
I think that the people we work with have the similar... You find the people who agree with you and who feel really impassioned by those things. And so it becomes a really nice way to build that community of people.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about access in particular and kind of breaking down that barrier of, oh, classical music is this pretentious thing that is only accessible to a certain group of people. What are some practical things to do in our communities to try to break down those walls and get people exposed to all kinds of music? And more so, I think even more importantly, making sure that young people have access to or to be, you know, are exposed to a lot of kinds of music and have access to go to find whatever kind of music speaks to them.
So there's a couple things that we focus on in what and how we do that, because we sort of differentiate between access and the fact that it's available and mm-hmm. access in the point that you have a context to relate it to.
Mm-hmm.
And context is really what we focus on. Music is everywhere and to the point that it's ubiquitous, and to say that someone doesn't have access to it is a little like it kind of cannot actually serve the point of improving
sure.
it. And our goal is to really create different levels of connection so that when someone thinks about hearing violin and piano, it's very easily to connect that to having a cup of coffee. It's very easy to connect, wow, I heard that piece from Bowen Hammer and it totally goes with this comic strip that I saw at their concert. Let's see what else. It's just sort of always creating context so that we're bringing it back into the focus, that it doesn't have to be this box of a concert hall. It can mm-hmm. actually just collaborate and be a part of daily life everywhere or anywhere.
I love that. I think that's so beautiful. So taking a step back even further, what do you think is kind of missing from the conversation around classical music when we're thinking about it, talking about it, interacting with it, going to see it, all of those things? Like, what's missing from it?
I think sometimes people... it's hard to look backwards and move forward at the same time. And I think that people often choose to do one or the other.
Hmm.
And I think what can be very valuable is balancing doing both. So I see that in a lot of different places in society in general. So it's not exclusive to classical
sure.
music. But I think that they are truly struggling with that because... recording because of, you know, any number of things. Classical music is specifically struggling with that. But I feel like to finding the things to value, the music itself, the community that it can create, the way that it can communicate, valuing those things, and that has always been something that's possible. And then moving forward to see how that can actually fit. That could be really helpful.
Yeah, I also feel like when we analyze problems, we really want to find the culprit
mm-hmm.
and then fix it and move on. And I feel like with the arts in general, there's sort of a wide range of things. Like we were talking earlier, it very much takes a village in this case. Sure, you can find problems with... you know, the way that you felt at a concert or, you know, that music was taken away from your school. You can definitely trace to things that have contributed. But as we move forward, you can see that, you know, a lot of institutions are actually really trying to make changes and trying to do stuff. There's a lot of groups coming out of Chicago. There are a lot of things happening. So I feel like the best thing we can do is constantly have an honest and, you know, reflective dialogue about how effective are we. It's not a value, mm-hmm. you know, it's just how can we be more how can we be more effective? How can we be more clear? How can we move forward and engage and not go down a specific rabbit hole of just, you know, solving the budget or whatever?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that there's, you mentioned there was a lot of groups coming out of Chicago right now. That's very exciting.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can, you have a lot of like updated marketing starting to happen where, you know, you see a San Diego Symphony just did that video and it was hilarious.
Oh,
and it was awesome.
Detroit has had some really great videos as well. Toronto had a symphony, had a huge thing about prepping their audiences with a phone app so that you could like do all this prep before you showed up to the concert so you knew what to be looking for and all this stuff.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah. And, you know, Hillary Hahn started off the 100 Days of Practice hashtag on Instagram, and that's kind of, you know, then you have Two Set doing all this sort of comedic stuff with playing.
And not taking yourself too seriously.
Yeah. So I feel like there's a lot starting to happen, but it's just as we continue to move forward, like, we just need to really continue to just be reflective and be honest with ourselves as artists, as a business, just because we have to, you know, respond to being productive in the ways that other businesses are as well, even though we're artists.
And I also think that within the classical music scene, I think it's easy to get territorial because it feels like we're always struggling, you know, to be an artist or under the stress to do well. And that's true. You know, we're all doing that. But I think that the niche that you find doesn't have to address everybody. And
that's
so
right.
I think if we were able to value each other's spot more, it doesn't have to be a competition. It can actually just be a community of things that work well together if we can all value them together. So you don't have to be a symphony person. You could be a chamber music person,
right,
or you could be a new music person, or you could be a, you know, with any number of these things. And it doesn't have to mean that you really hate the other one. You know, it doesn't have to isolate them.
Just kind of the you do you thing.
Yeah.
But find what you're good at. Do your thing. Do what speaks to you. We are talking with Catherine Sato and Elizabeth Newkirk. They make up Bow and Hammer. They have a show tomorrow at the Promontory in Hyde Park at 1:30.
Correct.
All right, 1:30. But then it goes to 2 every other, the rest of the Sundays. And
yes,
it's every Sunday.
It's the second Sunday of every month.
Second Sunday of every month.
Mm-hmm.
This one's at 1:30. But next month, keep going. It'll be at 2, and you don't want to miss it. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we're going to take a little break and come back and take you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And tonight, we're talking about classical music. A lot of times we pull in something from the news on this program and talk about it all night, but no, we're not doing that because we don't want to talk about politics. We want to talk about very, very beautiful pieces of music like the one you were just listening to. Of course, that's Debussy's Clair de Lune, a favorite of mine, a very, very beautiful piece of music. And we were just talking with the ladies from Bow and Hammer. And if you follow me on Twitter, which I hope you do, I'm at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H on Twitter. I just tweeted out some information about their show tomorrow at the Promontory and where you can follow them and get all their updates and all that good stuff. We are joined now by our very own Dave Schwann. He's, of course, a news anchor here at WGN, but he's also a personality on WFMT, the classical music station here in Chicago. Dave Schwann, thank you so much for being with us. Always a joy to have you here.
Well, hi, Amy. It's been a long time since we've talked, so it's good to be with you again. Yeah.
I know, right? It has been a minute. So my first thought when I'm thinking of the work you're doing at WFMT and just WFMT at all is, you know, this idea of broadcasting classical music for people because it's kind of its own, that's a special spot. It's not like a pop station fighting for space with other pop stations. Like there's just the one and it holds a special spot. So talk to me, if you would, about the idea of broadcasting classical music.
Well, broadcasting classical music is a little bit more than just playing the music and announcing it and then coming back after the piece is over. You may want to give a little background into the music that you're playing. If it's a familiar piece, you know, you'll say this is something that everybody knows or everybody loves, or if you're hearing it for the first time, sit down and listen. You might enjoy it. And if something is a little less familiar, you would want to give a little bit more information about that, too. Not too much, because you want to get right to the music. And that's true in any musical format. You know, you, whether you're playing classical music or jazz or rock, people want to hear the music, so that always does come first. Keep in mind also we do a lot of live broadcasting on WFMT, so it's not just playing CDs or streaming files. We do some live broadcasts all over the city. We do a weekly broadcast from the Cultural Center, the Dame Myra Hess Memorial Concerts every Wednesday afternoon. And I've been involved for the past few years broadcasting music of the Grant Park Music Festival, our wonderful Grant Park Orchestra. Terrific concerts live from the Pritzker Pavilion. So there's a lot to it.
You know, I think that is a perfect segue for what I wanted to ask you next. And that is really about when we think of classical music, I think we have this image in our head of like, a Baroque room and just a couple of, very fancy people and days gone by and watching this musical prodigy. And it was very closed and elite and all that. But, you know, what's great is exactly what you're talking about. These access points of the, you know, the Hess concerts and the Cultural Center and Pritzker Pavilion in the summer and all these places. Beyond that, which is not insignificant, what are some other spots that are really important to focus on when we're thinking about promoting classical music and sharing it and making sure people can access it as much as they want to?
I think one of the things you might want to think about is the amount of music that you hear that we term classical music. That's a very broad term, and how much of it we may hear and not even think about it. Certainly in a lot of films, right? Movies. John Williams comes to mind. I mentioned John, who wrote the score for the film Lincoln. And I bring up Lincoln specifically because he came to Chicago and conducted our Chicago Symphony for the soundtrack, for the score of that film. If you get a hold of a recording of that, you will see John Williams conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So you hear it in films. You hear it all over television. Primetime TV, you'll hear it. You'll hear it in commercials. So it's not just contained to what you just alluded to there, Amy, about a Baroque room, you know, mm-hmm. people listening to some prodigy 200 years ago playing the piano. It's all over the place. It yeah. really is. And it's affected so many other musicians in all different types of categories.
That's right. And of course, when you say John Williams, you don't mean WGN John Williams. That's a very different John Williams.
No, think Jaws John Williams. Think Close Encounters and Star Wars.
That's right.
But John is a very accomplished composer. He's written a lot of music for a lot of symphony orchestras outside the world of film music. So, and he's collaborated with Steven Spielberg for something like 45 years on all of these films that we know and love. And I might add that especially the Star Wars music has kind of entered the repertoire of orchestras all over the world. They will play excerpts from those scores, the familiar scores. So in that regard, film music has come into the quote-unquote classical music world in that regard.
Yeah, for sure. And in the next segment after the 8:30 news, we're going to be talking with Tony Scott Green, who is a composer for films and TV, and we're going to be talking with him about that specific thing. I think that will be a very interesting conversation. But when we're thinking about classical music, I think, you know, you've just kind of set that question up too, really, and created this perfect segue. And that is when we say classical, like how are you defining that? Because I think we think of that as a certain time period. It needs to sound a certain way. It may or may not have a harpsichord, but you know, as we're looking at film scores that are quite modern, it expands into something much bigger. So to you personally, how do you define it?
I just call it music. I know that is kind of a very, very generalized term, but when we talk about classical music, if you want to be strictly speaking about classical music, that term refers to a period in music history in Europe in about a roughly 75-year time period, from about 1750 to 1825. So you're talking Mozart, you're talking Haydn, and you're talking Beethoven for a good bit of his life. That is what's termed a classic or classical period, because composers followed a rather rigid way of composing, and then things kind of expanded or evolved, if you will, in the 19th century. And in the 20th century, we had all kinds of influences. And among, I have to say, one of the things that I think has played a big part in the access of classical music, especially in our time, is the access to recordings and the web. It's all over the place. And in the 18th and 19th century, it was confined to those little rooms or a small concert hall and meant for the elite elite. Mozart, Beethoven, for much of his life, they were writing for royalty. They were employed by princes. And so they were writing music for those audiences there. But it happened to go out and expand into, as things got more democratic, you had wider and wider access and exposure to that music. And then when they came to the United States in the 19th century, people like Theodore Thomas, that formed our own Chicago Symphony, brought that music here to America, to the United States, and you might say transplanted it here. So that's why we have it in this country. Hmm. So there's any number of things that can enter into that. But the classical is, I think it's termed that because of the fact that it just involves a symphony orchestra, and we associate symphony orchestras with Mozart and Beethoven. But there's so much more to it than that.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. I think that's a really an interesting point. And that sort of leads me to think about how, when especially we're talking about young people and young audiences, and when there's so many genres of music available, how do you start to provide context for classical music to young listeners, especially?
One of the things I think that's rather unfortunate in our time, Amy, is that there's not as much access to what we call classical music or symphonic music for young people as there once was. What I mean by that, it was on network television when I was growing up. And you have in large part to thank Leonard Bernstein for that, because he made it happen. I'll put it that way. He made it happen. But my feeling would be, don't be scared of it. Don't put it down. Just simply sit and listen. You may like some things. You may not like some things. A friend of mine who taught music at Columbia College here in Chicago once told me, he said, there are no rules. And what he meant by that was, you can listen to anything you want to and just take it one piece at a time. So, you know, rather than dismissing something entirely, if you have an opportunity to go hear our orchestras here or another musical group that's associated with classical music, the Hess concerts every Wednesday at the Cultural Center are free. So you have access to that. Simply check it out. See what you think.
Yeah, I think that's really, really good advice. And I think, too, adding historical context for pieces of art of any kind, not just music compositions, I think that's such an interesting thing. I think we talk about that a lot in terms of books, of books that were banned, books that are banned now because of something that they say then, and, you know, things like that. I think that's a really interesting topic, but I don't know that we spend as much time talking about the historic and political context of a piece of art when, and sometimes there was sort of an activist piece to it or a really important message buried in a piece of music that's really fascinating to me.
There's a very good story to your point there, Amy. I'll tell you a story about a 20th century composer in what was then the Soviet Union, Dmitri Shostakovich. Mm-hmm. Do you know that name?
I do.
Shostakovich? Okay, he wrote a couple of pieces of music, and he was writing music and living in the era of Joseph Stalin, which meant just sheer terror for the Soviet Union and people who rubbed him the wrong way in the least. Well, Shostakovich wrote a couple of pieces of music that Stalin did not like, and he really was fearing for his life as a result of that. Can you imagine that? He was fearing for his life simply because a government figure, the head of their government, didn't like what he was writing. So he had a chance to write a piece of music that was going to kind of bring him back into good graces. It turned out to be his Fifth Symphony, the Symphony No. 5. And that did go over. And you might say it saved his life, because that was, it put him back into favor. He, meaning Stalin, liked it. The public loved it. And the public still loves it to this day. It is a great piece of music. And you know, you can go on YouTube and hear all of this. So there's a good way for people to access this. But the political thing there was with Shostakovich was the fact that, you know, and other composers of his era, you were subject to not just criticism in the media, but you were subject to criticism from your own government. And if they didn't like it, you could be in trouble. So he was trying to write music that was showing the world what life was like in the Soviet Union under this iron grip. And there's all kinds of little messages written into Shostakovich's music. A good musicologist could tell you a little bit about more about it than I. But if you listen to that piece, you can kind of get the impression of, you know, some of the drabness and the terror that was involved in life in the Soviet Union in the 1930s.
Yeah, indeed. I think that's so fascinating. I think there's similar conversations around some of Mussorgsky's work, too. It's just so interesting with the political context. Well, I know you've got to run, and we got to get to break. So thank you so much for being with us, Dave Schwann. Always a pleasure.
It is a pleasure. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you so much. All right, well, we're going to take a little break and come back and keep having this conversation all about classical music and its context here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. So we are talking all tonight about, we're talking all about classical music and its context and all of these things. And we were just talking to Dave Schwann, who of course is a WGN news anchor, but also a personality on WFMT and knows a ton about a ton. Anytime you can get Dave Schwann on your show, you're winning at life is what
I say.
He's
the best.
He's so knowledgeable and thoughtful, and he's just, it's so lovely just to have a conversation with him in the hallway, much less on the air, because he's such a lovely person. But he raised a point at the end of our conversation, and I know he had to run, but he raised a point about kind of the political context of different composers and looking at what, you know, with any piece of art, right? You're trying to make a statement. I think especially in literature, we talk a lot about, you know, like, for example, like The Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. Classic children's story, but yet had heavy social and political messages for its time, and it was supposed to be this kind of activist piece. But on the break, Tom, you raised a very interesting point. Please share it with the listening public.
Yeah, I know a lot of people, maybe I don't know how recently or how old this thought has been, but when it comes to the work of Wagner, you know, who is known for his
big-time anti-Semite.
Yeah, big-time anti-Semite, largely mixed in with kind of Nazi imagery and Nazi messaging.
I don't know if kind of is the word.
Yeah,
kind of
is very overt. I know. I probably should not, you know, walk around it. It's very true. So, but you know, the Ring cycle specifically is so influential and so beloved. But I think he's one of these figures where you have to ask that question, you know, can we listen to this type of music, even though it does represent a man and is the work of a man who was an anti-Semite, was a Nazi, you know, mixed it with Nazi ideology and all that kind
and
of
really
stuff.
And really got on board with a kind of eugenics kind of racism for a while, too.
Yeah, he was a very specific type of guy, you know.
Specific
is a really... That's a four-letter word in this context. But it sucks because you hear the Rite of the Valkyries.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're just like, wow, that is iconic, you know, for in so many different ways. So, I don't know. I've just always been curious about
that
question.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, I think that's another, you know, topic for another show. But
sure.
But I think that it's one that people are thinking about right now as we're going through all of the things and continue to go through all the things with the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. When do you separate the artist from their art? Can you, you know, is it ethical to go see a film by someone who is maybe a predator or, you know, is inappropriate to women, something like that?
Like, I really wish I skipped Fantastic Beasts, not only because that's a terrible movie, but also Johnny Depp is in it, you know?
Yeah.
And I can't support that.
Right. And and I think on social media, we always see that, like, when an accusation surfaces, that person's, someone who's a fan of that person's art will be like, oh man, this person too, I loved him. As if to say, I mean, the context is, and now I can't look at them as an artist now without also knowing this about them. So I think you raise a very good point about Wagner.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. Maybe we shouldn't think of it as can or can't, but
choose to
understand. I think you could probably listen to Wagner and be like, let's talk about his past and let's talk about how this was integral to Nazi imagery and it promoted anti-Semitism, but that doesn't by necessity make it not beautiful music. Maybe it's maybe one of those spectrum things. I don't know.
I mean, that's a really interesting subject.
This is something people have been asking themselves for decades. Certainly before I was ever born, people are asking themselves, can we listen? Can we promote this sort of artist?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting topic. And in fact, speaking of music, we were just talking about this the other day because this conversation emerged around the song Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Yeah.
In which, a radio station has pulled it from the rotation of holiday music. And a lot of people are going, yeah, right now you should not be playing the song. You should never play it again. It's creepy. It's predatory. And we were kind of discussing that very topic.
Yeah.
To me,
art is tough.
Art is tough. And context is so key. I was actually just having this conversation yesterday about why context and purpose attached to art is so crucial. But to me, Baby, It's Cold Outside comes down to, first of all, it's annoying. Let the woman go home. She wants to go home, leave her alone. But it comes down to the line, say, what's in that drink? Mm-hmm. To me, that switches from him trying to be coercive and just let it go, dude. She wants to go home, to, okay, you've possibly just given her a roofie.
Yes.
So maybe not with that.
Maybe not.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think it's an interesting topic. But we need to take a break, get to news, all those good things. When we come back, we are talking with composer Tony Scott Green right here in the studio. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all evening long. And tonight, that topic is classical music. And we've been having some really cool conversations about cool classical music things right here in Chicago. And I would love to welcome our next guest, Tony Scott Green. He is a composer for film, TV, and commercial projects and has created music for feature films, TV shows, documentaries, web series, marketing, advertising, you name it. He has made music for it and done all the things. So welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Amy.
You have a quote on your website that I think is very cool and really it seems like it kind of sums up a lot of the work you do. And it says, my goal is to make music that breaks down the barriers between audiences and the visions of creative, passionate people. The right music helps an audience see better. Is that seems like kind of a North Star for you and your approach to things?
I think it is. I think that's true for a lot of film composers too, because film music is a little bit different from regular classical or modern music. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily designed to stand on its own. It's designed to be listened to while you're watching something. So it's not just about, if you can listen to it on its own, it sounds great. More often than not, that's a happy accident. But you have to remember, you're trying to make something else better. You're trying to create something bigger than just the sum of parts.
And so for you, what was the inroad into music initially in your life?
I started playing guitar when I was 12 or 13 years old because I think I wasn't terribly athletic and I wasn't very academic, and that seemed like a way to impress girls. So
that's always the way. So many people have picked up guitars to impress girls.
That's what it seems like, yeah.
And you are in a band?
I was at the time.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, I was at the time. I was in several different bands, and then it just kind of developed from there. But
And so your work spans a lot of things.
Right.
And so I would love to kind of talk through that process, because as you said, it's not meant to necessarily be a standalone piece of music. So what is your approach to when you're scoring a film or some kind of other media project?
Well, you're often involved kind of you're involved sort of towards the end of the process, because you've got a locked picture. So let's imagine you've got a feature film. And finally, they've shot everything, they've edited, and they've gone through multiple iterations of the edits. And finally, they say, visually, we've got the thing done. And you have something that was called a locked picture. Supposedly, no more changes. And that's really when you can really get to work. Because the music really has to sync up very, very closely, right down to the millisecond, with what's happening on the screen. So you're really trying to do that. And really what you're trying to do is you're trying to, you know, you're working with the director to figure out what do we want people to feel? Are they feeling it from the visuals alone? What does the music have to do here? Do we even need music here? Sometimes you say, you know what, the scene doesn't need music. People will get the feeling we want just through the script and the acting, the photography itself. Other times you do need the music. So it really is a collaboration between the director, the editor, and the composer.
And would you say that your approach is different by different genres of music?
You know, probably not really, because in some ways I think of myself as a musician third. I think I'm a storyteller first, a filmmaker second, then musician third. So the music is third in the list for me. So I'm thinking about the story and I'm thinking about the film. And so my approach is pretty much the same no matter what the genre of music is.
Yeah. And so when you're working with filmmakers, I have to imagine there would be some points that are quite frustrating of like, I don't really know what I want. I don't, like, I kind of want this vibe, but I don't, not that, not this. I mean, what is, you know, how do you troubleshoot that process when a filmmaker is just kind of going, I don't know, I just want it to sound cool right here.
Exactly. Well, you can try different things. The great thing about the technology today is that we can very quickly turn around little new samples, new ideas. They can be right there in the room. We don't have to wait for an orchestra. We don't have to wait for other live musicians. We can use the computer. We can use sampled instruments. So very quickly we can say, well, what if it sounded like this? Or what if it was this? What if it was electronic? What if we did a chamber arrangement? We can do things like that really quickly and see what really sticks.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's so fascinating. And this is an interesting extra layer to add to the program tonight.
Sure.
You know, to think of this in this context. We were talking a little bit earlier with Dave Schwann, who's a news anchor here, but also an announcer on WFMT. And he started to talk about that a little bit because I asked him how he defined classical music. And he said, you know, we think of it as kind of being this one era. And yes, it is from about 1750 to 1825. And yet we're looking at symphonic compositions like Star Wars and things like that.
That's
and so
right.
It quickly got into a film-based conversation.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny when you think a lot of people who wouldn't go to classical concerts will listen to a lot of classical based music. So let's say they'll listen to Lord of the Rings, they'll listen to all the Star Wars. And of course, that film music has now worked its way into concert hall repertoires. People will now go to listen just the Lord of the Rings suite or the Star Wars suite at a place like the Chicago Symphony.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, we see those kind of things advertised all the time.
Sure.
Yeah. So on that note, kind of, there was a little bit of a, I wouldn't say controversy, because I don't know if it got big enough to be controversy, but there was some conversation after Black Panther came out about how a lot of the orchestra that did that soundtrack was white. Mm-hmm. And in this kind of moment when there was a shift and such a significant film was out, and a lot of people were really identifying with it and feeling very strongly about that film. And so, you know, where does that kind of thing fall? You know, there's like the idea of representation and what story can we each tell?
You know, that's a really tough thing to answer. It's a great question, but it's a tough question to really answer. Representation obviously is important, more important than ever. It's certainly not going away. The musicians are there, especially in Hollywood. Those musicians are getting the job because they're first call musicians. They're musicians who come in because a lot of people don't realize that when you hear a score, movie score, those musicians haven't rehearsed it. They've sight read it.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they show up, and so the musicians are there are the ones who are the very best at sight reading. So you see all those musicians there. It's not like the Chicago Symphony. There's no multiple rehearsals. They come in, they'll do maybe one run through, and they're expected to sight read it. And they have to get it right, because then that's what's committed to the hard disk, and that's what ends up on the soundtrack. So the people who are getting those jobs turn out to be the best musicians, the people who are able to do that.
That's fascinating,
yeah.
and a lot of pressure.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to
Absolutely.
Be the one person like, oh, I hit the wrong note. That's me. My bad.
I know. Because when you think about, you've got maybe 20 people in the control room, you've got 60, 70, 80 people on the soundstage, and the meter is running.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
There's some really neat pictures here from old days of WGN radio, in which it was the theater of the air.
I just saw them out in the green room.
Yeah.
They're fantastic.
They're so neat.
Yeah.
They're fascinating. And the idea, you know, I talked with my esteemed producer, Tom Hush, all the time of like, there was someone producing that. Can you imagine what a nightmare that would be?
That's right. And it's so early on that, so, you know, 1945 or so, full orchestra, broadcast over the air with a live audience. That's fantastic.
That's a lot. That's a lot. There, some of those recordings still exist, and they're really, really quite cool.
That'd be great.
To dig them up and share them with you. We're talking with film composer Tony Scott Green, all about this big conversation we're having tonight, all about music, classical music, all this cool stuff happening right here in Chicago. We're going to take a little break and come right back in just a bit to continue this conversation here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special, and we've been talking all about classical music tonight, particularly in Chicago, and the context for music and how it exists in our lives. And so how could that conversation possibly be complete without speaking with Tony Scott Green, who is a composer for film and TV and other media projects, and he makes very, very beautiful, beautiful scores to many cool projects, and he's been talking with us about that. So I want to shift a little bit when we're thinking about Chicago, and you're so immersed in the music world here. You know, you could like swing a cat over your head and you're going to find a rock show every single night of the week. Yeah. Those are so easy to find. But when we're, and probably jazz too, that's probably less easy, but it's there. When we're thinking about classical music and the experiences of classical music and all the forms that it can take, what are your thoughts on access? Because it still seems like there's a lot of inroads that have been made, but on some level, it's still kind of hidden unless you're really immersed in that world, it seems like.
Sure, I think that's true. And, you know, I think that when people think about classical music in Chicago, it's easy to think about Chicago Symphony and Lyric Opera. And sometimes there, I mean, you're seeing two of the world's greatest orchestras right there. So, you know, what a treat it is to have the two of them here in town. And to your point about access, you're quite right. There are other ways to find classical music, and in some cases more contemporary classical music, which is not a contradiction in terms. But, you know, you've got all these university orchestras and college orchestras who are fantastic. These are people who are maybe students and will soon be auditioning for those world-class orchestras, who are catching them on the upswing of their careers. And oftentimes they might be doing work that's a little more out there, a little more adventurous, and that's really exciting. So that's a great way to access. And of course, you've got smaller ensembles around town as well who have great reputations. Eighth Blackbird, the Grammy-winning ensemble, is right here in town. Third Coast Percussion, also a Grammy-winning percussion, contemporary classical ensemble, is right here in town. They were just at the Humanities Festival doing a piece that Philip Glass composed just for them. So once you get beyond the traditional venues, there are a lot of other great ensembles, and even venues like the Hideout and Constellation, even jazz venues will start doing more esoteric classical things because they see the crossover and see that their audience is hungry for that too.
That's really interesting to me. I mean, I think that, and I was just having a conversation about this yesterday, but I think it's really interesting that it seems like we're in a very experimental time creatively. Like we're seeing television looks a lot more cinematic than it used to.
Right.
And so those lines are kind of blurring a little bit with web series and TV series and things like that. And I think that maybe could be happening. I mean, you know better than I do, but it seems like maybe that could be happening a little bit with music, or at least there's an appetite for it of kind of crossing genres a little bit.
Well, there absolutely is. There's a huge acceptance for more kind of genre-defying music right now. I mean, we were talking about, you know, film music being classical-based, but of course, we know that's not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, audiences are much more willing to accept either classical music, which is much more adventurous, or even more modern music, which is kind of atonal. It's even verging on noise music. It's audiences through film are really willing to accept much more adventurous music than you'd ever go hear in a concert hall. It's really exciting.
I think that's really interesting. And I want to back up to one of the groups that you mentioned, because specifically you said the phrase Philip Glass composed it for them. And I feel like you are doing something right and living your best life at that point.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, Philip Glass, obviously one of the giants of minimalist and modern composing, along with people like, you know, Steve Reich and Terry Riley. And, you know, it's not unusual to hear their music in films. Philip Glass, in fact, has had a very nice career writing for film, and he sees no difference whatsoever between the two, whether he's writing for the concert hall or writing for the screen.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
So when we think about music in general, or maybe specifically in Chicago, what is kind of missing from the conversation that you see from the inside that perhaps outsiders are not seeing looking in?
You touched on it earlier, and for me, you know, representation is big and access is big. So access, not just in terms of how can we get to hear the music, but access in terms of are there potential music students, school kids, CPS school kids in Chicago, who realize that this is a legitimate career that they can have. So how are we finding those students? How do we understand what access are we providing for them and saying, this isn't just a hobby. This is a real career you can have, and there are people here who are doing it. There are people you can talk to. There are people who can mentor you and can guide you through that. So for me, outreach and access are really big issues.
Yeah, yeah. I asked when I had Bo and Hammer in earlier, I asked them both, like, what led you to music? And they both started very early. I think one was seven, one was kindergarten. And I think that's so critical to let young people believe that's a possible option.
That's absolutely right. And a lot of times you start them early, but then there's no sense of where the bridge is. You can't see how to get across to the next level. And unless you have access to people who are doing it, who can mentor and guide you, then it can be really difficult.
Yeah. And probably not helpful when you have a parent going, you can't make a career out of that.
it's tricky, right? So, you know, how do you fight that?
Yeah, yeah, lots of things to consider, but I think that's so important. Like, arts programming in the schools is so, so important. Well, we're going to run out of time in a bit, but I want to talk about a couple of things that you have going on before you run away. And one of them, there's a crowdfunding campaign for a feature that you're part of.
Yeah, this is actually, it's a film that screened at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year. And it's a couple of great producers in town, Nathan Gilbert and Megan Marie Connolly. The film is called Dear Frankie, and they're raising funds for an Indiegogo. And that's just going to be a great film. Film that I think is ultimately going to be a feature, and that's really exciting. The other thing that's fun that I have a little more personal interest in is that this Tuesday at the Theatre Wit, Elevated Films is doing the Chicago Shorts Showcase, and the film director called Curtis Matsky has a film called The Orchestra, which I had the great pleasure of scoring, and that's going to be screening on Tuesday night at the Theatre Wit.
That's really fun. Where can people go to find out more about that? It's probably on the Theatre Wit website.
Yes, it'll be the Theatre Wit website. If you go to Elevated Films Chicago, just Google that, you'll find that event. And if you go to Indiegogo and search for Dear Frankie, you'll find the Dear Frankie fundraising campaign.
And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and share links to both of these things so you can find them and all that good stuff and when we share the podcast for this. Well, before we wrap up, what is the project that when you are imagining, you know, scoring a film or some kind of media project, what is just the project that you almost can't even dream of it because it just sounds too cool to do? Or have you done that already, like the dream project?
I've done a lot of, it's funny, the dream project always changes because once you get it, it's like, okay, now I have to get a new dream project.
That's right.
And I've been lucky enough that there's always been, I've always found new projects and new things and had to rise to new challenges. For me, I think that the gold standard is the relationship that the composer Carter Burwell has with the Coen brothers and how they've really been collaborators over 20, maybe even 30 years.
Yeah.
And I look at that relationship and the quality of the films and music that are being produced. Now, for me, that really is the gold standard.
Yeah.
And to have a relationship with filmmakers like that and aspire to that level of work, I think is a noble aspiration.
Very noble aspiration. Very, very cool. Well, your work is all over the place. There's so many things that we can see your work in. And so everybody head to tonyscottgreen.com to learn more, to keep in touch, all that good stuff. Tony, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me on, Amy. It's a pleasure.
Super appreciate it. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and get you ready because Dave Hoekstra's Nocturnal Journal is coming up here in just a bit. So we're going to check in with him perhaps and see what he's got going on the show. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. And it's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special, and that does it for us this time. We will see you next time with a brand new topic, and we will talk about it all evening long.